Support for this KQED podcast comes from Bay Meadows, an urban village in San Mateo. Fitness and movies in the park, Caltrain, artisan eateries, fun for the kids, all just a hop from your front door. Homes now selling and leasing. BayMeadows.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on the Forum program this morning, award-winning poet Rick Ryan will join us in the top segment of the hour to discuss his autobiographical novel, There's a Man with a Gun Over There. It's about a man who tries to avoid combat by becoming a military policeman in Germany during the war in Vietnam. Then at 10:30, we'll be joined by representatives of the Silicon Valley Ballet to talk about how the company avoided being shut down and to give us a preview of the classic ballet Giselle, which will be staged by them later this month with strong ties to Cuba. Join us for Forum. It's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. In 1968, Iram Ryan was an American trying to get out of the draft. He ended up in Germany working with the U.S. military police away from the front lines in Vietnam, but still embroiled in violence. He tells his story in an autobiographical novel titled There's a Man with a Gun Over There. And in this Forum segment, we talk to the author and an award-winning poet about his wartime experience and the writing that emerged from it. We welcome R.M. Ryan, Rick Ryan, to the Forum program.
Thank you, Michael.
Delighted to have you here. And this is a autobiographical novel, as called, and maybe we can talk about where fiction and autobiography merge. But what I was struck by in this novel, I just want to talk about how you did this. You're writing from really two different past perspectives. You're a kid in Janesville during the Cold War, Janesville, Wisconsin.
Correct.
And you're also an adult avoiding going into combat by being a military policeman in Germany, Mannheim mainly. And to do those two simultaneously and sort of in seriatim was really quite a trick, I thought. You have to put yourself in the mind of the boy and then you put yourself in the mind of the man.
Well, that's very interesting, and you've picked up something that was very important to me, Michael. I think both of those things are true. Your preceding guest kind of had all the dots connected, and I was really, this book was about trying to connect the dots.
Which you do. I mean, in your life, obviously, but you also do in terms of the military. There's a great deal in this book about race, and
yes.
I want to talk about that and about Vietnam, but let's talk actually first about race, because as a military policeman, you have to arrest a guy who happens to be African-American, a black marketer selling cigarettes and the like, and seems to you to be pretty petty stuff, but you have to serve the military and do your job.
Well, Germany, after the end of the war, was very concerned about its currency. Cigarettes and nylons and booze had sort of replaced the Reichsmark, and they were very concerned about black marketing. So they set up this whole big legal apparatus to stop it. And in 1970, I arrived, and they were still doing it. And a lot of the black marketing was done by very unsophisticated people. And I was actually quite ashamed of myself in arresting these people, but, you know, they were violating the law. And
may I say the shame comes through and guilt, too.
Oh, yes. I feel very guilty about what I did.
There are people who feel guilty about being in the rice paddies of Vietnam, usually, not necessarily being not stateside, but European side, like you were in Germany.
Well, of course, I had a lot of advantages being in Germany, but I think one of my goals in this novel was to try to talk about how the military affects really just about everyone. And we could start with the fact that everyone in a combat arm of the military is a trained killer. And I was a trained killer. And I think that's a real issue. We've got millions of us running around.
You do make that clear in the novel, that military trains killers and that the military is something to be discouraged, military service, especially now that we don't have conscription and maybe a volunteer army. And in fact, at one point, it's like you're addressing, we'll actually have you read a passage from here, but you say early on, why should you care? These are my troubles, right? I should work them out in private. They don't affect you, do they? They're not coming after you, are they? You're writing to a kind of audience that's listening to you.
Well, I think, you said that there were probably two voices. There's the voice of the kid in Janesville, the voice of the guy in Mannheim, but I think there's also my voice now addressing people, and I think they need to think about this. Henry Kissinger really gets going in about 1968, which is when I was being drafted, and we can say a lot of things about the government, but, you know, there were just a tissue of lies told by everyone about Vietnam, and including the what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Well, you say the military taught you how to lie.
Exactly, they did.
Talk about that a bit.
Well, because first of all, I was enforcing laws that I thought were ridiculous. I mean, cigarettes sold for 19 cents a pack in a PX, and cigarettes on the German economy were $2 or $3 a pack. So the opportunities for black marketing were there, and for enforce those laws was ridiculous. But if I hadn't enforced those laws, I would have gone to Vietnam. And this is also a book about compromises. I worked with really old Nazis, and I got really a taste of all that. And I don't think that, you know, everybody says, well, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have, you know, something in the Holocaust I wouldn't have done. And I'm very, very skeptical of that.
Well, you work with old Nazis. You also work with a guy named Goldberg who was Jewish. So
right.
My best
friend, in fact, still my best friend. He's really disguised in the book. His name is Silverman, but we're very close friends.
Well, you're right about this whole experience of sort of being in league with the empire, as you call it. I mean, this is right out of 60s thinking in many
right.
ways, and having to do its bidding by arresting people for sort of chicken type stuff or small type of stuff. Like the African-American guy, Sergeant Perkins, he can't believe that you're arresting
right.
him. But it's your job to get a confession, and it's your job to, in fact, everybody's telling you, you got to tally up the number of people that you arrest and convict.
That's we did have to do that, and I was quite good at it, actually. And in fact, I got a medal at the end of my time, and it taught me a lot of lessons about living. You know, I later went to work. I was an investment officer for a brokerage firm, and I saw lots of illegal things go on. By that time, I wasn't interested in anything like that, but I saw a lot. I think this book, in a way, is a small object lesson to people who think that lying is a good idea.
We're talking with R.M. Ryan, poet and author. His book is There's a Man with a Gun Over There. It's an autobiographical novel about his time served in the military police during the Vietnam War. What does that mean? What does that word serve mean to you, Rick? I mean, people say, thank you for your service, and I served my country. And if the military makes us lie and the military makes us train killers, how do we serve our country, if not in that fashion?
That's a very good question, Michael. I don't regard... Well, sir, you know, you're right. I served.
You served and you were decorated, in fact.
Well, I served my own ends. And what I was good at was sort of seeing what the military wanted, and I did what they wanted. And I think if you talk to a lot of veterans, that's what they've done. And luckily, I never got there's kind of a scene at the end of this book where it looks like someone is killed. And I never killed anyone, but I could have. I could have easily.
Did you really meet Albert Speer? Why is Albert Speer?
No, actually, the person who met him was my friend Silverman, but I have a pretty good description of him.
He plays an important role in this novel.
Oh, yes.
Albert Speer was the architect, Hitler's architect, who, of course, wrote about his great remorse after the Second World War ended, and who became a figure of, well, some historical weight, to put it mildly. There's also there's some very compelling personal scenes in this book, I must say. There's a teacher that we meet, your high school teacher back in Janesville, who broke down in the class over the Korean War, and you wanted to make contact with him years later. And you write about that, but you also write about your mother when you decided, or seemed to be deciding, you were going to avoid conscription and go to Toronto. And at one point, she began, I found this like right out of Hemingway almost, "I'll never see you again if you go there. You can't do that, Ricky. Can't you just tell them I'm a widow? They wouldn't take a widow's only boy, would they?" She began hiccuping as she sobbed, a pudgy little old lady who'd been a yellow rose in the Rose Parade in Pasadena in 1925. Wow, I got to say, I mean, just in getting back to her whole history and her sobbing at that moment. And you've also got your father breaking down, nervous breakdown, knifing a table repeatedly, right, and so forth. This must have been painful stuff to go back to.
It was very painful stuff, but I felt like this was a part of the story. I almost like I didn't have any choice. I had to write this story. And in a way, this, in a way, I think is a kind of lyric poem. It could probably be broken up into lines, I think.
How is writing an autobiographical different than writing a poem? Or why couldn't this have been lyric poetry?
Somebody one time said that poems are like affairs and novels are like marriages. Poems
could have been Chekhov.
In reading, we were talking earlier about Ray Carver. And I think that he began really writing poems almost exclusively at the end of his life because they were fast. He could get them down very fast.
Well, he said stories you could get in and out, too. He got fast with stories,
right,
as well. We're talking again with R.M. Ryan. His book is There's a Man with a Gun Over There. And by the way, if you'd like to join this conversation, you are certainly cordially invited to do so. I'd be interested in hearing maybe from some who served in country, that is, as they say, in Vietnam, or remembered the Vietnam War, and maybe even some of you who tried to evade the Vietnam War, either through doing something that didn't get you on the front lines or as part of the artillery, or maybe simply evaded it by doing the sorts of things that Rick Ryan writes about in his book, that is, trying to find a medical way out or trying to find a conscientious objector a way out. And be interested in hearing from some people maybe who have experience as military policemen and what that work involves. There's a line in this book where he says, you know, barbers look at people in terms of haircuts, and military police or police in general look at people in terms of the possibility of arresting them. We do invite your participation. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can feel free to join us now at that number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your own responses or questions onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I should mention that this book tells us about a unit that Rick Ryan was in, which was the same unit, I guess, that went to Kent State. Yeah.
We were told, I'm not sure this is correct, but we were told at training for MP duty that they had trained the shooters at Kent State, and I'm not sure that is true. One thing about the military is there are all kinds of made-up stories, and it gets, when you get into it, it's very hard to separate fact from fiction. But be that as it may, our instructors could have trained the shooters at Kent State.
How did you separate fact from fiction? You're writing about your life here, but you're writing it as a novelist?
Well, I'm writing as a novelist, and I think there is more fiction probably in the government and what they told us about various things than I could ever imagine. I went to the Paley Media Center and watched all the 1968 convention, which was fascinating to see. But the streets of Chicago looked like a war zone. narrated by Ed Bradley, who was a Vietnam correspondent for CBS. And it was amazing, the transition between the kind of made-up world of the convention and what was going on in the streets.
We're going to hear you read a passage, but first let me bring a caller on here. And Gary, join us. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, I was 21 years old in 1968. I did everything I could to stay out of the Vietnam War. My father was career military. He was in Cam Ranh Bay from about 1972, I think, 73. And I was called down at Fort Halliburton 3 times for draft physicals. I managed to stay out. I had a college deferment up until that point. One of my friends, right before he got drafted, he was an excellent musician, saxophone, different horn instruments. He joined the Navy band. So he spent the Vietnam War in the Navy band. My other friend wasn't so lucky. He got drafted at 19, and he lasted 5 months in Vietnam, and he's on the wall. But it was a pretty horrific time, and I have to laugh today when people say they're not free. There's so much freer than we were back then. I mean, we had an obligation. I wasn't going to run away, but I really didn't want to go in the military.
Understood.
Neither did I.
Neither did I, but I had what was called a National Defense Education Act fellowship, and it actually got me out of the military.
Wow.
The Johnson administration was pretty free with revenue in those days to help those who were seeking higher education. Let me bring another caller on. And Neil, that's you. Good morning.
Yeah, I was an MP at Fort Dix, New Jersey during the war, 69 to 71. Hmm. I can't help but wonder, was there much difference between serving stateside and serving overseas, even in a non-combat zone? Was there any, did you hear any or discover any profound differences?
Well, I never served stateside. I was shipped from MP school at Fort Gordon, Georgia then, directly overseas, so I didn't have any experience. I did briefly work in uniform, and the Army at that point, well, this is interesting, was actually collapsing. Discipline was just collapsing. And then I worked undercover as a detective, and we were actually sort of scary, but when I was in uniform, nobody listened to us.
Let me thank Neil for the call. It's also, you're talking about the government lying and the unnecessary kinds of tricks of one sort or another that are pretty much identified with government. There were 500,000 people still in Germany when you were there.
I think that's right.
After World War II. I mean, and they stayed for a long time. American troops stayed for a long time. Now you have American troops literally all over the world in places where perhaps they don't need to be.
Well, you know, this is probably about business and it's about money. And I, you know, in my opinion, what is it? Joan Didion says something like, we tell stories to make sense of our lives. And that's a story I finally came up with. It took me 20 years, but I think this is all about money.
Let me bring another caller on. And Peter, that's you. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, I just wanted to share an experience. I was a 18-year-old matriculating at Cal Berkeley in 1969, and there were plenty of draft counselors around and so on. And so I decided to apply for conscientious objector status, and I found it to be a really soul-searching experience. And actually, it's something I would recommend to any young person or any person to really ask yourself, well, am I willing to kill and under what circumstances? And I found it very kind of shaky in terms of the world and my view of the world, because what I found is, even as a mild-mannered, privileged boy from Piedmont, I did find a lot of potential violence in me, and as a result of this process, I kind of purged it out of my system. And once I felt that I had drained that intention out of my system that I didn't even know was there, I became kind of disturbed, because I said, oh my gosh, if I, you know, had that much in me, what's the rest of the world like? We're like walking powder kegs as individuals, and we don't even know it a lot of times. And that really influenced my life and career, and I'm very grateful for that experience. I'm not sure I would have the same answers today. They would be more nuanced, for sure, but
well, less testosterone today, at least, right? But thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
For that. You went through the whole CO application, Rick.
No, I didn't. I was actually, I never thought I would be drafted. I was in graduate school, and I think
you were studying Emerson and Yeats.
I was studying Emerson and Yeats, but you know, I don't think I was paying attention to the poems like Lapis Lazuli with were the best lack. What is it? The best lack all of all conviction. And the worst are full of passionate intensity, which probably applies today.
Applies to almost any era, unfortunately. It's part of Yeats's genius that he could encapsulate right. that the way he did. Let's get Rick on here. Rick, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was listening on my car radio. I served in the 101st Airborne in 1968. I was wounded and sent to Walter Reed Hospital, and as I was laying in the bed, I saw what appeared to be a convention on TV, and I asked someone, what is happening? And they said, oh, it's a Democratic convention. I said, why are the police hitting people? And they tried to explain to me that the police were rioting. When I left Walter Reed, I reported to Fort Bragg and joined an anti-war GI group and was followed by the Criminal Investigation Department. Because I later talked to my friend Dave Walker, who got his FBI file to the FOIA, and he said, my name is in his file. So they were wasting money following GIs who were exerting their using their First Amendment rights to protest. But this was all part and parcel of what was going on at that time.
Yeah. Again, I thank you, Rick, for that call. Another Rick who called in here. And comment on our website, a listener writes, I'd like to hear the guest's comments about how Martin Luther King advised black GIs to not participate in the war if they could not avoid being drafted. These men were then denied GI benefits even when they spent 2 years in Vietnam.
I can't really answer that, though. I can tell you when I was in the Army, black power was really, really going to town. And among black people, there was incredible insubordination, and the Army was coming apart. That's why we got rid of the drafted Army.
Well, the book is a message to those who might be considering a military career or life in the military, and
right.
Your story is very compelling for me as a reader. Rick Ryan, thank you so much for
thank
joining
you.
Us. R.M. Ryan, poet, author of the book There's a Man with a Gun Over There, an autobiographical novel about his time in the military police during the Vietnam War. We do have another segment of forum coming your way. We're going to talk with representatives from the San Jose Ballet. Actually, they're now called the Silicon Valley Ballet. They're premiering Giselle with a Cuban twist. We'll talk to the artistic director, as well as Millicent Powers, who is co-chair of the board and executive director. And stay tuned for that. We, in fact, encourage you, especially those of you down in the South Bay, to think about a question that I have in my mind. Are the arts really getting their fair share? Are they getting the support that they deserve down there? We'll talk to the guests about that, and we'll hear from you. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.